Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. My Name Upon the Wind by Peter Tremaine. He lay on his back on the bed, but he was not asleep. The curtains were drawn back from the dominant leaded bay window, showing the night sky clear and blue-black and studded with a myriad of white winking stars beyond. The moon was in the first quarter, not bright but drifting constantly, a pale, listless orb behind dark scudding clouds. He lay bathed in sweat, the cold sweat of fear. His lips were dry and cracked. He could only think one thought. If only he were here. If only. He felt unable to move, unable to get up from the bed. He tried to reach out his hand, to tug on the bell rope, which hung at the side of his pillow, to summon his servants to his aid. He wanted someone to secure the open windows, to draw the curtains, to shut out the night sky. Its aspect seemed so forbidding, and it disturbed him. There was something portentous about the doleful hanging moon. He writhed on the bed, feeling no control over his wasted limbs. Spittle formed around his mouth as he worked his jaw in an attempt to cry out. The only sound he could make was a soft moaning, like the suppressed sobbing of a fractious child awaiting an inevitable punishment. Then, scarcely audible against the soft sighing of the wind in the trees outside, he thought he heard his name being called. His eyes widened fearfully. Yes, yes, there it was, a soft whispering summons. His name being called upon the wind. Then he was aware of the figure in his bedroom, the figure standing just inside the door, looking at him. The eyes were the only part of that fearful shape that he could focus on. Eyes red and malignant, eyes gloating and evil, merciless. A throaty, voluptuous chuckle welled from the mouth of the threatening apparition. Slowly it moved towards him. He tried to scream, but no sound came from his restricted throat. All he could hear now was that sighing call his name upon the wind. Abraham Van Helsing, even though he was now in his early 60s, had never ceased to have an eye for a pretty girl. Perhaps that was why he had never been satisfied in a single relationship, why he had never married. Women found his only dependable quality was a constant adoration of feminine beauty. Many of his fellow academics at Amsterdam's old university found this behavior both surprising and sometimes embarrassing. Women, however, found that it was something which did not make for a durable partnership. Hence, Van Helsing had remained a bachelor. Even as Van Helsing came down the gangway of the ferry onto the granite quay of the Irish port of Kingstown, he noticed the girl standing alone under one of the pale flickering gas lamps which illuminated the area. She was draped from pole to toe in a long dark cloak. The lamps were too dim to discern his exact color. What could be clearly seen, however, was her pale, worried face peering anxiously up at the ship. It was a delicate face, finely shaped, which, while not exactly beautiful, was somehow beyond mere beauty. An exquisite face, which made Van Helsing's breath catch in his throat. The eyes were fretful and impatient, searching eyes. Searching for a husband, a lover. Van Helsing pursed his lips in thought. Then, for a moment, the apprehensive, somehow vulnerable eyes of the girl met Van Helsing's admiring gaze and boldly held it. Her eyes seemed to bore into him for several long seconds, until it was Van Helsing who reluctantly dropped his countenance in embarrassment. He came to the foot of the gangway and was preparing to turn into the crowd when, to his astonishment, he found the slight form of the girl barring his way. "Are you Dr. Van Helsing from Amsterdam?" she demanded, her voice breathless and troubled. Van Helsing showed surprise by a slight rising of an eyebrow. "I am he," he replied in his oddly accented English. The girl, to his continued wonderment, suddenly thrust out both hands impulsively and gripped his free hand in an unexpectedly strong grasp. "Thank God you've come. I've been waiting for you," she said softly. Then, seeing the bewilderment on his face, she said, "I am Sarah Mountcarberry." The bewilderment cleared immediately from the Dutch professor's features. "Then you are. I am the sister of Piers Mountcarberry," she confirmed before he could finish his question. "I am come to meet you, doctor, and to take you straight to Castle Carberry." She glanced down at the portmanteau he was carrying in his left hand. "Is that all your baggage?" Van Helsing attempted to smile. The girl's worried features seemed to forbid gaiety. "One travels faster who is not encumbered with baggage, young miss, and when your message came to me, I simply picked up a bag and took the first ship to Harwich, and trained across England to Holyhead, and from there," he gestured to the ferry behind him. "Then follow me," she replied, not answering his wry smile. Her face was now a stiff, unemotional mask, although Van Helsing felt it was a mask that hid a great deal. "I have my carriage here." She led the way across the crowded quay to where a solitary coachman stood by a dark calèche, a four-wheeled covered coach, harnessed to a pair of impatient horses. The coachman, a tall man with a long brown beard and a great black hat, left the horses and moved swiftly to open the door of the carriage at their approach. He did not say a word, but handed up the girl and took the portmanteau from Van Helsing's hand. He waited until Van Helsing had clambered in beside Sarah Mountcarberry before closing the door. He placed the portmanteau under the seat on the driver's box, then he climbed up. With a flick of his whip, he turned the calèche across the stone flagged quay and out into the dimly lit street of Kingstown. The coach moved at a remarkably quick pace. The only lights were the oil lamps fitted on each side of the vehicle, which helped the driver keep to his road. So rapidly did the carriage proceed that they soon left all habitation behind and were deep into the darkness of the country beyond. Van Helsing was unused to such swiftness of movement, but he assured himself that the coachman knew his business and eventually settled back, turning slightly in his seat so that he might view the girl's shadowy profile. "How is your brother, Piers? In your message you said that he was ailing and had great need of me." Van Helsing saw the girl bite her lip in the gloom. She hesitated a moment before replying. "He is in very poor health, doctor. I have not seen him in nearly 10 years. He was a student of mine with young John Seward in Amsterdam." The girl shivered slightly. He felt the movement rather than saw it. "I know. In fact, it was a letter from his friend, Dr. Seward, which prompted Piers to ask me to contact you." "Is this so?" asked Van Helsing, his tone inviting further explanation. "Dr. Seward wrote to Piers to say that you have been of tremendous help with some obscure virus that brought ruin to a family called Westenra in England. I do not know the details, only that Piers was very excited by what Dr. Seward wrote to him and asked me to write and plead for you to come here without delay." Van Helsing's face had paled slightly. "So," he exhaled a deep breath, "the Westenra case. You tell me that your brother is ailing? How long has he been so?" "For a fortnight now. For some 10 days before I sent my letter to you." "He has seen a physician?" "No. He lets no physician near him. He treats himself, for, as you are aware, doctor, Piers is qualified as a physician." Van Helsing compressed his lips. This I know. He was licensed at the Royal College of Physicians here in Ireland before he came to study with me in Amsterdam. It was after I had read his paper in the Dublin Journal of Medical Science that I invited him to Amsterdam to study further various forms of obscure..." He hesitated and smiled. "But you know all this. He was one of my best students. I was sad to hear from my good friend John Seward some months ago that Piers was quitting the profession of medicine." "Why was this? He was not ill then, surely?" The young girl sniffed. "He found himself with other duties." "Other studies, Miss Sarah? May I call you Miss Sarah, for the sake of the friendship I hold with your brother?" The girl grimaced, neither approving nor disapproving. Our father was the 11th Earl of Mount Carberry. We have estates at Annagdown in the Wicklow Mountains. When our father died 3 months ago, Piers had to forget his medical interests, for he became the 12th Earl. There were new duties to consider. Our family came to this country 700 years ago with Strongbow, and are looked to as influential in the life of the country. Piers is the 28th generation of our line to hold the estates of Annagdown. He has a responsibility to the family, to its traditions, and to the people. Van Helsing heard the rising pride in the girl's voice. And yet the vocation of a healer is an honorable profession, he ventured mildly. The girl made no reply. He could not see her features well in the darkness of the carriage, but had a strong feeling that she disagreed with his observation. Tell me more about Piers' illness, he invited, after a moment or two of silence. How did it start? The girl sniffed. He observed that she used a sniff as others use punctuation. It was part of her speech pattern. It detracted from her elegance, he thought disapprovingly. I do not know. I only returned to Ireland 2 weeks ago. I have been abroad for a while in Europe. When I returned to Castle Carberry, I found Piers complaining of a feeling of lassitude. He was sleeping fitfully, and yet when he did sleep, it was such, or so he told me, as filled with curious dreams. He found he was rising late and was still listless. He now seemed so pale, almost anemic. Van Helsing thrust out his lower lip, a little habit he had when he heard disturbing news. This is unlike the Piers Mount Carberry I knew in Amsterdam, he remarked thoughtfully. Indeed, Piers Mount Carberry had been a tall, well-built, red-headed Irishman with a laugh that was like the roar of an express train. If Van Helsing was to conjure the epitome of a healthy man and the full vigor and strength of life, it would have been the image of Piers Mount Carberry who came to mind. The main point is, can you help him? Sarah Mount Carberry suddenly turned her face to his. The cold ice blue of the moonlight suddenly flitted into the carriage and illuminated her mask-like features for a moment. Van Helsing stared into her deep, dark eyes, unable to discern the subtlety of her expression. I can only answer, Miss Sarah, that I shall endeavor to do so. I can say no more until I have seen my young friend again. The carriage swayed and rumbled along the narrow roadway through the darkened mountain. Van Helsing felt that the girl was in a state of tension and that further conversation would not ease it. So he sat in silence, meditating on what he had been told. It had only been a few months previously that he had returned from the Carpathian Mountains with his friends, John Seward and Jonathan and Mina Harker. How relieved he had been to bring that extraordinary episode to an end. It had been with a sense of foreboding that he had read the hastily scrawled message from the sister of his old student, Piers Mount Carberry. Why had Piers asked her to send for him after receiving a letter from John Seward? And now, as Miss Sarah described the malady from which Piers was suffering, he found a clammy coldness on the nape of his neck, a sense of déjà vu. He reached up a hand and ran a finger around the inside of his starched collar, as if to ease the sudden constriction he felt in his throat. They had been traveling several hours. Van Helsing realized that it must be approaching dawn. He was about to ask how much further the Mount Carberry estate was when the driver suddenly pulled rein on the horses, and Van Helsing heard a shouting in a language he did not understand. What? He began. The girl stirred at his side. We are at the gates of our estate. Oh. Van Helsing suddenly remembered that he was in a land where two languages were spoken. And your coachman calls his instructions in the Irish language? Is this not so? The girl nodded affirmatively. Most people in the country still speak the old tongue, she conceded. He simply tells the gatekeeper to open the gates that we may proceed. The calèche was rumbling forward again. To Van Helsing's surprise, it was a further half hour before the girl suddenly pointed towards the window on his side of the carriage. That's Castle Carberry. Yet I do not understand why there are so many lights on. To call the house a castle was a wild overstatement, thought Van Helsing as he viewed the dark outlines of the building. Castle Carberry was not, it never had been a castle. It was a sedate Georgian country mansion, fit to be inhabited by people of moderate fortune. Van Helsing had yet to learn that most of the Anglo-Irish aristocracy were impecunious, with their only dignity and their pretensions to supply a subsistence. The old castles from which they had set forth to conquer Ireland and carve their own initial fortunes had generally fallen into ruin and neglect. The continuing wars of conquest, confiscation of estates, and wave after wave of new colonists from England had not given the old Anglo-Irish the peace and security to grow rich and prosper any more than it had done for the long-suffering native Irish aristocracy, who had been forcibly dispersed to France, Spain, and Austria. After the devastating conquest of William of Orange, those Anglo-Irish who survived had found it necessary to leave their crumbling castles and move into more modest houses, because they still clung to their taste for the grandiose. They considered it undignified to live in simple houses or mansions, and thus called them castles still. Such was the Castle Carberry, home of the Earls of Montcarberry. The main thing Van Helsing noticed, which the girl had drawn attention to, was that several windows of the house shone with light as the carriage approached the house along the broad, curving driveway, which brought it to a halt before the main arched doorway. There was a tall woman standing at the door, obviously awaiting the approach of the carriage. The driver pulled rein outside, and at once a harsh female voice cried out in the same language that Van Helsing had previously heard. "What is the matter?" he demanded. The coachman was helping Sarah Montcarberry down from the carriage. The tall, hard-faced woman came hurrying forward. She spoke rapidly in her own language to the girl. Van Helsing, as he clambered down after the girl, noticed that the woman's eyes held a cold glint as she spoke, staring down towards the Dutchman while addressing the girl. She spoke in staccato tones in Irish, to which the girl responded shortly and with a sharpness in her voice. Then the woman spoke more slowly, and Sarah Montcarberry's response was a small cry of anguish, a hand going to her cheek. Van Helsing instinctively knew what the news would be, even before the girl turned to translate the harsh tones of the woman. "Piers is dead," she said in a choking voice. Then the girl's eyes rolled back, and she fell into a faint. Only his quick response prevented her from falling to the ground. He caught her in his arms, for Van Helsing was a powerful man, in spite of his advancing years. "Where may I put her?" he snapped at the anxious servant, at the same time striding towards the house. The tall, raw-boned woman hurried at his side. "Oh, sir, sir, place her in the library. There's a fire there." Van Helsing glanced at her in irritation. "Where is the library?" he demanded. She bobbed and waved before him, ushering him to the house, while muttering aside in her own tongue. She led the way into a room leading off the large hallway. There was a chaise lounge in the library, and he laid the girl upon it, checking her pulse and respiration. "I'm a doctor," he explained to the woman, who hovered at his side, anxiety in her face. "Your mistress has only fainted. Do you have smelling salts?" The woman nodded reluctantly. "Then get them. She will revive presently. In the meantime, get someone to show me his lordship's room." "His lordship's room?" The woman looked startled. "Lord Montcarberry," snapped Van Helsing. "Oh, Master Piers. Very well, Master Piers' room. Has any other doctor been called for?" The woman shook her head. "Master Piers forbade any doctor to attend him. We knew that Miss Sarah had gone to meet you from Kingstown and would return soon. We heard her say that you were a doctor, so thought it best to wait your arrival." "When did his lordship's Master Piers' death occur?"
"I can't say exactly, sir. It was some time after Miss Sarah had left to meet you, just after midnight. I went to take Master Piers a drink. He usually became thirsty in the night, sir. That's when I discovered him. Her eyes widened suddenly as she glanced at someone entering the room behind him. Van Helsing swung around. It was the tall, brown-bearded coachman, now divested of his driving coat. He and the woman exchanged a half-dozen rapid-fire sentences in their native tongue before the man turned to Van Helsing. "I am Dragan, sir," he said.
"You are the coachman?" queried Van Helsing, in bemusement, for usually a coachman did not make so free of the interior domain of his master's house.
The man did not smile. I am also the factor of the estate. I have many responsibilities here.
And who are you?
Van Helsing turned to the woman, who had secured a few of smelling salts from a cupboard and was about to apply them to the young unconscious girl's nostrils.
I am Mrs. Bebbin, sir, the housekeeper.
Van Helsing sighed. Very well, Mrs. Bebbin. Revive Miss Sarah and give her what comfort you can. And now, Drajan,
is that your name?
You may take me to Master Pierre's bedchamber.
What does your name mean, by the way?
It has a familiar ring.
In our Irish language, it means a blackthorn tree, sir.
Drajan, the factor, turned and led the way into the hall. There were no other servants about. The factor was a powerfully built man, whose pale face lay hidden behind his beard. He took an already lighted lamp from a side table and began to ascend the stairs. Van Helsing clambered after the man's broad-shouldered form, having to quicken his pace to keep up. The tall man had a long stride. As he ascended, Van Helsing pulled forth his hunter gold watch and flicked open the lid. It was 4 o'clock in the morning.
Would you know if anything has been touched? I mean, has the corpse been touched since the discovery?
Drajan shook his head, glancing at Van Helsing with a curious light in his eye. Everything has been left as it was, doctor, he said without emotion. Or so I am informed.
Dad ascended the broad oak wood stair to a main landing, holding the lamp high.
Drajan turned and hesitated before the door. Then, as if summoning some resolve, he bent and unlocked it from the key that was in the lock. Van Helsing raised an eyebrow. The man saw the gesture and shrugged.
Mrs. Bebbin, thought it better to secure him until you arrive, sir.
Until we know. He gave a grimace. Until we know what virus the young master died of. He pushed open the door and stood aside to let Van Helsing enter, holding the lamp high.
Van Helsing hesitated on the threshold.
Will you want me to come in, sir?
He caught a curious tone in Dragan's voice.
He reached out a hand for the lamp and shook his head. No, my friend. You may wait outside. I will only be a short while.
Van Helsing entered the room and, closing the door behind him, he stood with his back to it, surveying the room. It was a large bedchamber. There were heavy curtains at the windows, but they were not drawn. One of the windows was open to the chill night air, giving a view of the dark mountains outside and the pale sky which precedes dawn. It was cold, and Van Helsing, shivering slightly, went to shut the window. Something on the window sill caught his eye. It was a small circular wafer which had been broken in half. Frowning, he picked it up and peered closely at it. "And God," he whispered, "this surely is a piece of the sacred host." Carefully, he took out his wallet and placed it inside. Turning, he saw the large four-poster, an old-fashioned style bed, that dominated the room. There were 2 candles burning on either side of the bed, and there was an overpowering smell of camphor. Van Helsing walked slowly towards the still figure that lay in the bed. He halted beside it and placed the lamp on a side table. In life, Pierce Mount Carberry had been, as Van Helsing remembered, a tall, large-boned, red-haired man of considerable vitality and well-proportioned muscles. In death, he lay white and shrunken, with a terrible expression on his waxing features. It was an expression of utter terror. No one had thought to close the eyelids and hide that awesome stare of death. Van Helsing shivered slightly and cast a glance around as if to observe if any danger threatened. Then he slipped a hand inside his pocket and drew out a silver crucifix attached to a long silver chain, and this he hung around his neck. He stood for a moment before the corpse and took a deep breath. He reached forward with his hands, and with difficulty he manipulated the lids into position. Then he drew back the stiffening flesh around the mouth, peering at the elongated incisors with a sickening feeling of resignation. He examined the neck. The wounds were blue-black and ugly, 2 rounded, discolored mounds above the jugular vein. He exhaled sharply.
"God in Dibimel," he muttered, "again, is there no end to this evil?"
He took a mirror and, wiping clean the surface, held it above the corpse's mouth, for a while staring at its bland, unreflective surface. Then, with his mouth compressed more tightly, he drew back the covers and made a careful examination of the body. before he finally stood upright, again staring down at the face.
Ah, poor Piers. You knew, yet you could do nothing.
Van Helsing's voice was a whisper. With all your knowledge and strength, yet you were still powerless. Why? He was about to draw the sheet back over the body when his eyes caught sight of a scrap of paper half hidden under the hand of the corpse. He carefully prized it from the stiffening fingers and smoothed the crumpled sheet. He had no difficulty recognizing the scrawled handwriting of his former student. It was a poem. I see black dragons mount the sky. I can see earth yawn beneath my feet. I feel within the asp the worm that will not sleep and cannot die. Fair though may show the winding sheet, I hear all night as through a storm, hoarse voices calling, calling, my name upon the wind, all omens monstrous and appalling, affright my guilty mind. Van Helsing blinked, took out his wallet and carefully placed the paper inside it. He looked back down at the corpse. Fear not, young friend, for the peace of your soul, he murmured. I'm here now. You shall find peace. You shall. He replaced the crucifix beneath his shirt, picked up the lamp, and turned from the room. Dragan was waiting outside with troubled eyes. The servant took the lamp from Van Helsing's hand. For a moment, his hand touched Van Helsing's own, cold and corpse-like. The Dutchman tried to suppress a shudder and cursed himself for his imagination. There is much to be done, Van Helsing said. Can a priest be sent for? The man looked startled. Why so? A funeral must be arranged as soon as possible. The virus that he died from may well be contagious. Where will he be interred? Dragan looked worried. All the Montcarberries are buried in the old castle chapel, about a mile from here. I can send for the minister as soon as it is light. He paused and added, The Montcarberries were Protestant folk, sir, unlike the natives hereabouts. Van Helsing turned toward a window where the first pale streaks of light were now heralding the dawn. He was frowning. Protestants, you say? Master Piers had no dealings with the Catholic Church? Dragan shook his head. None, sir. We are nearly at sunrise, Van Helsing sighed after a moment. Let the arrangements be carried out quickly. The medical responsibility shall be mine. With due respect, sir, I have to take my orders from Miss Sarah. Van Helsing suppressed a sigh. The man was right, of course. Very well. I will ask her to consent to this. They went downstairs to where Mrs. Bevan was waiting in the hallway. And how is the young miss? Demanded Van Helsing. Have you deserted her? Oh, no, sir. She sent me to discover what was happening. The woman was clearly indignant. Then I will go in and speak with her, replied Van Helsing. And if there's some tea to be had and something to eat, the discomfiture of hunger, I would be grateful. Mrs. Bevan went off to perform the task, followed by Dragan. Van Helsing paused outside the library door, knocking, and hearing a sound, entered. The girl was still in the chaise lounge, but was in a more upright position. The smelling salts lay on her lap. She had recovered her senses. Doctor, is it true? There was no hope in her eyes, and he said a simple truth, the only way to deal with her. Oh, a syllable was a soft sigh in response to his news. I'm afraid the virus has proved fatal, my poor young miss. I must therefore seek the origins of it and so destroy it. Yet to prevent further spread, our poor dear friend Pierce must be laid to rest without delay. She stared at him in comprehension. The sooner his body can be interred, the sooner we may cease our concerns for contagion. Is the disease then so contagious? Unless prevented, poor miss, it is very contagious. This is so bad a virus. And his excitement, Van Helsing always found the constructions of his own language tended to dominate his English. Then it shall be as you say. The girl shivered suddenly. I am so fatigued, doctor, and the shock has so distressed me, but I must retire a while. Please treat the house as if it were your own. I will go to my bed now and join you later in the day when I have rested. She rang a bell, which was immediately answered by Mrs. Bevan. If you need anything, doctor, simply ask Mrs. Bevan or Dragan, who is also the factor of the estate. He manages everything, she added. You will give him your instructions concerning the arrangements for my brother's funeral. They will be carried out as if I gave them myself. She paused at the doorway and looked back at Van Helsing. Do you have any objections if I pay my respects to my brother? Van Helsing compressed his lips a moment. You must swear that you will only stand in the open doorway and not go near the body. She gazed at him in perplexity a moment, then sighed and nodded as she presumed that he feared that she might contract the virus. After she had left, Mrs. Bevan said, "Will you take breakfast in the dining room, sir?" "You must tell me where it is," smiled Van Helsing. Mrs. Bevan did not answer his smile, but conducted him to another doorway leading off the main hall, which led into a large dining room. "I will eat here," Van Helsing said solemnly. "Send Dragan to me again, telling him of what Miss Sarah has said, that my orders are her orders." A moment later, the tall bearded man entered. "I have already dispatched the stable boy for Mr. Bell, the local minister." "And is there a coffin maker in these parts?" "There is." "Then you may convey the importance to him, as well as the minister, that the interment should not be later than sundown today." Dragon's eyebrows shot up. "Sundown? Today, sir?" "Precisely so. Now, there are two things I would like to see," Van Helsing said, as Mrs. Bevan entered with a tray. Van Helsing wrinkled his nose at the plate of greasy bacon and eggs under the silver cover. He settled for the tree, toast, and honey. "Two things you wish to see, sir?" prompted Dragan, as Van Helsing busied himself over breakfast. "Yes, I would like to see the place of interment, and then I would like to meet your local Catholic priest." "But Master Pierce was not a Catholic, sir," protested Dragan. "I have already told you this. Mr. Bell was his minister." "I do not question your information. Nevertheless, I would like to see the priest." Dragan bit his lower lip to suppress a sigh. His expression betrayed his opinions of this officious, interfering Dutchman. One of the stable lads, a fair-headed youth named Enda, conducted Van Helsing to the old deserted chapel, which was the burial place of many generations of Mount Carberry's. The chapel was surrounded by an assortment of tombs and crypts. One of these impressive vaults was a recent marble construction bearing a dedication to the 11th Earl, who had been Pierre's father. Having examined the strong iron gates which barred the entrance to the tomb, watched by the curious eyes of the stable lad, Van Helsing indicated that he was ready to move on to see the parochial house where the priest dwelt. Father McCarthy, the priest, was a surprisingly youthful-looking man. He was of powerful build and of a vigorous disposition, although something seemed to be wrong with his eyes, for he wore tinted glasses, such as the blind affected to wear, and he was sitting in a shaded room when the housekeeper showed Van Helsing into the man's study and announced him. "Forgive me greeting you in near darkness, sir." The priest rose to shake his hand with so firm a grip that Van Helsing almost winced. "I had an accident." He gestured to the wall where, to Van Helsing's surprise, a bow and a quiver of arrows was hanging on a hook. "My hobby, sir. I like to play the archer. But a few days ago, the bow broke as I was stringing an arrow and the flight scratched my eye. I need to rest it from harsh light." He paused and smiled thinly. "What can I do for you, sir? You are a stranger to our district. I don't think I caught your name properly." "Dr. Hulse?" Van Helsing reintroduced himself and told the priest briefly for his reasons for visiting Castle Carberry. The priest's face whitened. "Dead, you say? And it was only 2 days ago that I was speaking with Piers. He was looking forward to your coming. I know your name now. Your reputation is well known to me through Piers." "So you knew Piers well?" "Well enough. I was a fellow student with him at the Royal College in Dublin. Then I found my vocation. I went to study at the Irish College in Rome, and after ordination, I spent 2 years doing missionary work in Constanta." Van Helsing was thoughtful. "That's a port on the Black Sea coast, is it not?" "It is. I am but recently returned home to Ireland, where coincidence has made me curate of this parish. But tell me, doctor, of what did Piers die?"
"Of as terrible disease as can be conceived by man, father."
Father McCarthy stared at him a moment. Van Helsing opened his wallet and carefully extracted the piece of the sacred host. He laid it down on the desk between them. "This, I imagine, was your doing?"
"What makes you say so?" Father McCarthy seemed to avert his gaze from the sacrificial office. "Piers was not a Catholic. Why would he defend his bedchamber windows with fragments of a sacred host? The origin of this wafer is clearly a Catholic one."
Father McCarthy pressed his lips into a thin line. "The host is the body of Christ."
it is not to be used in any fashion that degrades it, no matter how laudable the cause. Then only in an extreme would you have sought to protect your friend, our friend, by this means. You knew what Pierre suspected was happening to him. What did he suspect, doctor? The priest countered. That he was being attacked by the undead. Father McCarthy's face went white. I know of no such thing, he whispered. I have reason to believe that my young friend Pierce has fallen victim to an undead. We both know what that means. His soul cannot rest in peace. Before midnight, he will walk abroad again. He will walk abroad, damned to spread the vile contamination further. Sacred Heart of Jesus, breathed the young priest. His features were screwed up in agony. I have come to you, Father, because I have need of you. As soon as Pierce is interred, I need to visit the grave end. Well, there is much I must do to prevent this evil contagion. I too have need of a sanctified host. Father McCarthy's face was white. Do you know what you ask? He whispered. I cannot sanction it. It will not be degraded, but will protect perhaps countless souls from everlasting hell. I must think on this. And while you think, let me ask you what Pierce confided to you about his illness and anxiety. Father McCarthy tugged at his lower lip. I knew that he was ill. When did you discover this? Soon after Sarah and I arrived back here at the castle. When you and Sarah arrived back? Snapped Van Helsing in surprise. Sarah had been abroad a year or so. By coincidence, she joined a ship I was taking passage on at Piraeus. From there we journeyed home together. Van Helsing recalled that the girl had told him that she had only just returned to Ireland after being away in Europe. Go on, Father. What did you know of Pierre's mental state? I knew that he was fearful. He had come to fear an old family legend. Van Helsing eased forward in his chair, frowning. A legend? Yes, but there are many such legends in Ireland. Tell me this one. It is just a legend. In legend may be found many truths. You found it so compelling that you supplied him with a host. So tell me, are we not fighting evil together? The priest thought a moment or two and then shrugged. When Strongbow, the Earl of Pembroke, landed with his Anglo-Norman knights in Ireland to conquer this land, he had a knight called Walter Fitzwilliam under his command. This Walter was the founder of the House of Montcarbery, for he took the daughter of King Carberry as his wife. Like most Norman knights of the time, he was a cruel man who seized what he wanted and held on to it. He claimed the kingship of Carberry by killing all the Carberry's family except his daughter, Befind, whom he forced to marry him. By Befind he begot his children. The accounts say that she would not give in to him, and each time he forced her by rape, keeping her imprisoned in his castle. It was said that Befind became demented and renounced the living God, in whose name these Norman plunderers acted. The Normans had received the blessings of the popes in their invasion and despoilment of Ireland. Van Helsing looked astonished. Father McCarthy nodded grimly. Oh, yes. Both Pope Adrian IV and Pope Alexander III urged and approved the invasion of Ireland. So Befind, daughter of Carberry, disowned the living God and ritually cursed her husband with all the dark powers of the pagan priest of the Druids. Every seventh generation would be damned. Utterly damned. Father McCarthy's voice had risen with a strange vehemence. He cut off abruptly. Pierce was worried because he was the 28th generation in descent from Walter, and had learned that every seven generation, the head of the Montcarbery family, the title taken by the descendants of Walter Fitzwilliam and the poor Lady Befind, had died or disappeared in mysterious circumstances. I thought that it was this which was making him ill. Van Helsing looked unhappy. You do not believe in this curse? I have said that there are many such tales in Ireland. You cannot go to a country which has been conquered in the manner that Ireland has, and not expect to hear stories of curses, massacres, and killings, of cruel men and wrongs that need to be avenged. Do you say that you do not believe in the curse of evil, in the curse of the undead? Father McCarthy looked uncomfortable. If I believe in good, then it follows that I must believe in evil.
But let me tell you this, my friend. I have seen such evil walking abroad, evil clad in rotting flesh, spreading like a disease among the living. It was something that I had hoped never to encounter again. The sun was setting, and the small circle of mourners gathered in the private cemetery before the vaulted crypt of the last Earl of Montcarberry. Van Helsing was astonished that only the small band of servants had come to carry the coffin and pay their last respects. Mrs. Bebben had told him that Miss Sarah was feeling too unwell to attend, and that she had to stay with her, and Dragan was not there, but had, apparently, been sent hither on some mission. Of all those attending, only Van Helsing and the hawk-like minister were not members of the Montcarberry household. The minister was a short, angular man, pale of skin and a shock of brilliant white hair, which fell to his shoulders. He looked like some patriarch of old. His beak-like nose and thin red lips and eyes that burnt with some strange pale fire added to an otherworldly impression as he stabbed at the air above the coffin with his skeletal hands. "Grant this man eternal peace, great Creator," he called in a reedy thin voice. "Forgive his sins, which are many, and save him from eternal damnation, from the everlasting and consuming fires of hell, from the horrors of eternal purgatory." Van Helsing winced at the icy vehemence in the man's voice. Even in asking for forgiveness and compassion, the minister made it sound like an invocation to punishment. He sinned. Aye, we all sin. But he pandered to the scarlet harlot of Rome. He suffered papishers into his house and sought their friendship. Heretics they are who will burn for all eternity. I know them.
Suddenly the minister threw out a hand, stabbing into the oncoming gloom of the evening with his sharp forefinger. He pointed upwards. "I see you, heretic. You are doomed to suffer the everlasting torments of damnation." Van Helsing found himself turning in the direction in which the minister was pointing. To surprise, he saw a figure standing on a little mound overlooking the cemetery, but outside its walls. A great cloak was flapping around it in the evening breeze. Van Helsing narrowed his eyes. It was silhouetted against the lowering sun. It was difficult to recognize, but Van Helsing was sure that it was Father McCarthy. "Begone, heretic, harbinger of the evil one. I recognize you for what you are," screamed the minister. Van Helsing saw the figure of the priest hesitate, as if he would dispute with him. Minister Bell raised his Bible and held it aloft. "I need no popish images to challenge you," he yelled, spittle at his mouth. "I need only the true word of God." Father McCarthy turned abruptly on his heel and disappeared from sight. The minister then turned to the huddled group of servants, who were muttering uneasily amongst themselves. "Ah, children, children, I know you stumble in the ways of Roman ignorance. Repent. Repent before the dead body of your master." Van Helsing bit his lip in annoyance. "Surely, minister, this is not the time or place to preach conversion. We are here to lay to rest our young friend Piers Montcarberry." Minister Bell spun around, his eyes glowing. "Rest? Lay to rest, you say? This young man goes into damnation for his sins." The old minister's wild eyes abruptly widened to stare over Van Helsing's shoulder. Did Van Helsing see some strange, terrible expression in them? The old man's arm raised upward again, jabbing into the uncommon gloom. "I see him. I see him, spawn of the devil. Only the fires of damnation will expedite his sin." Van Helsing turned his head. On the rise, behind the graveyard, where the tack from Castle Carberry wound its way down to the chapel, in its ground stood a calèche. The tall, brown-bearded man was seated on the driver's box. The setting sun shone, and its amber rays bathed the carriage in a curious brown rust red, so that it seemed that the entire calèche was drenched in blood. "Evil stalks this place. Only when Castle Carberry is no more will life return to the land of death, which is yet undeath." Without another word, the old minister turned and clambered into a trap drawn by a single horse and whipped it into a canter away from the cemetery. Van Helsing swallowed hard. It was the most astonishing funeral service he had ever attended. The servant stood silent a moment, their heads staring toward the park calèche on the hillside. Then the tall man on the driver's box seemed to flick the reins, and it moved off into the gloom. Several of the stable lads moved hurriedly forward now and lifted the coffin.
Van Helsing noticed that one or two of them swiftly genuflected before the act. Then the coffin was taken with almost indecent haste into the crypt and left. It was just after midnight. Van Helsing crouched uncomfortably beside one of the tombs in the grounds of the old castle chapel and burial ground. He had borrowed a horse from the stables at Castle Carberry, and with his worn leather medical bag, which he had extracted from his portmanteau, he had ridden to this place an hour before midnight. Now he shifted uneasily and peered at his hunter fob watch again. Such a vigil was better shared with friends, but there was no one he could trust in this strange land. He was hoping that he could have trusted Father McCarthy. How strange that the minister, Mr. Bell, could rebuke him so publicly and call him evil. What did he mean by that? There was a slight change in the atmosphere, which suddenly caught his attention. He felt a distinct chill and shivered violently. He glanced towards the crypt in which Piers Monk Carberry had been laid that afternoon. A white, ethereal mist seemed to be drifting under the metal door. Van Helsing compressed his lips into a thin line. He had been right. It was happening as he had said it must. The mist rose, forming and reforming, until it resolved itself and vanished. In its place stood the tall, unmistakable figure of Piers Monk Carberry, clad as he had been dressed for his coffin. The figure cocked an ear, and two bright eyes, burning like coals from the fires of hell, stared straight towards Van Helsing. The Dutch professor eased himself up, realizing that further concealment was useless. "My doctor," Pierre's voice was smooth and cajoling, "it is good to see you here. I have felt your presence for some hours. I am honored that you have come to see me. To see me and perhaps to join me?" The tall figure began to walk, no, or glide, yes. It seemed to glide without movement across the overgrown cemetery towards him. Van Helsing pulled aside his coat and revealed the silver crucifix at his neck. "Ah, I should have known." The figure of Pierre stopped its motion. The face was momentarily baffled and annoyed. Van Helsing took a step forward. He cleared his throat. "I'm speaking to the spirit that was once Piers Monk Carberry, a young man of noble thought indeed, who was once my friend. Piers, young friend, if your soul still lingers in this vile shell, tell me what evil was responsible for this. Piers, can you tell me?" The figure began to chuckle. "I'm Piers, good doctor. I'm Piers for all eternity now." "What great undead has severed you from real life?" cried Van Helsing. "One who called my name upon the wind," sneered the creature, making a dart forward towards him. Van Helsing raised his crucifix and began to intone a Latin prayer. With a grimace of disgust, the spectre reduced himself to elemental mist and began to retreat towards the crypt. Undaunted by the sight, Van Helsing hurried swiftly towards the crypt. The door was easily open. He was in time to see the opaque mist vanish into the new coffin which had been laid inside. Van Helsing had gambled. He had gambled that the new unborn form of Piers Monk Carberry was weakened by its first movement abroad, for the corpse had not suckled its first blood as yet. It had none of the vile nourishment needed to sustain such long periods of activity without rest. Van Helsing unscrewed the lid of the coffin as quickly as he dared. The corpse lay there, with a strangely somnolent expression on its face. Van Helsing bent over it, making sure the crucifix was at his throat. "Is the spirit called Piers Monk Carberry within this shell?" he called softly. The eyes blinked. They were not alive, neither did they glow, as in the chapel yard, with that strange red vehemence. The mouth did not move, but a strange whisper seemed to echo from the body. "I am still here. Help me. Help me." Van Helsing gave a sharp intake of breath. "I'm here, Piers," he said triumphantly. "I have come to help you. Before I do so, my young friend, you must tell me. Tell me, if you have the strength, name the great undead who has done this evil thing to you. Help me, Professor." The voice was a moan of pain. "Do not let me succumb to this, to grow stronger every moment. Have a care. The name of the undead, Piers, then you may rest in peace." "The undead, it is..." Van Helsing heard the movement a second before. A heavy hand sent them flying across the crypt, cannoning into a pillar. As he sought to regain his balance, he heard a terrible cry of pain. Blinking, Van Helsing recovered his balance and stared back towards the coffin. Father McCarthy was bending over the corpse, chanting in Latin. With a suppressed exclamation, Van Helsing moved forward. The priest was still gripping with both hands the wooden shaft of an arrow, which he had driven directly through the heart of the corpse. Blood was bubbling up, black and thick, all around it.
"You damned fool!" cried the professor in agitation. "You fool! You have prevented him revealing the name of the source of this evil."
The priest shook his fierce head. "I've destroyed the devil's spawn. This thing was not living. It was a creature of Satan. I did what I had to do." He threw back his head and began to laugh uncontrollably. The priest was hysterical. Van Helsing leaned forward and slapped the priest across the cheek. The laughter stopped at once. Father McCarthy staggered backwards and stared at him in astonishment. Van Helsing ignored him, turned back to the coffin and gazing down. There was no doubt that Piers Montcarberry was in peace now. Yet there was one or two things left to do. He looked at Father McCarthy. "Did you come prepared to finish this night's work, Father?" The priest shook his head, hanging it before the older man like an intractable schoolboy. "I do not know what you mean." "You knew enough to realize that a wooden stake must be driven through the heart of a vampire." McCarthy blinked rapidly but did not reply. Van Helsing sighed in irritation. "Very well. I am prepared." From a small doctor's bag, he selected a scalpel. "What do you intend to do?" whispered the priest. "Give my poor friend eternal rest," replied Van Helsing shortly, and turning, he drew the scalpel squiggly across the throat of the corpse.
"Blasphemers! Spawn of Satan!"
the old cracked voice shrieked through the stillness of the crypt, reverberating in its intensity. Van Helsing glanced toward the door, the scalpel still held in his hand. He froze momentarily over the coffin. The thin, angular feature of the old minister Bell stood at the entrance, clutching his Bible.
"Back! Dogs of the evil one, back, I say!"
He advanced with his Bible upheld.
"Wait!" cried Van Helsing. "You do not know what you have intruded upon."
"I do not know.
I have come across blasphemy and sacrilege. You, sir, are hand in glove with the devil's spawn, with the scarlet harlot of Rome. What papish blasphemies are you at?"
The pale cold eye of the minister suddenly fell on the silver crucifix at Van Helsing's neck. To the Dutchman's surprise, the pale-faced man flinched, as if in physical pain, and backed away. At once suspicion shot through the professor, and he suddenly advanced a pace, holding up the crucifix before him as a talisman. "Do you abjure the devil and all his works?" he demanded. "Do you acknowledge Christ as the living God and Mary as his mother?" he demanded. The minister closed his eyes and moaned, holding his hands to his ears.
"I will never acknowledge heresy," he cried.
Van Helsing moved quickly across the crypt to the old man and laid the crucifix upon his forehead in one swift motion. The old minister screamed, and with a surprising twist of strength, he grabbed Van Helsing's arm and flung him backwards. Van Helsing rolled over on the floor, managing to regain his hold on the crucifix, and he stared up at the minister. To his utter astonishment, there was no imprint of burned flesh on his forehead of the man. The crucifix had not left the mark, as he had believed it would.
But you are not an undead," breathed Van Helsing in bewilderment.
"Heretics! Blasphemers!" screamed the old man. "I shall return and drive you out of this land." He turned and vanished with surprising swiftness for one so aged, vanishing rapidly into the night. As Van Helsing picked himself up from the floor, he heard a sobbing chuckle and turned around. Father McCarthy was standing in the back of the crypt, his shoulders heaving.
"You poor fool," breathed the priest, catching his breath.
"The old man is a Protestant, a diehard who abjures the symbols of our faith. He was reacting to the crucifix as a symbol in his eyes of idolatry. You thought he was reacting from fear of it as a symbol of good?" Van Helsing exhaled in annoyance, began to dust himself down. "I have little understanding of the ways of this land. I did not expect to encounter such fanaticism among priests." Father McCarthy seemed to recover his equilibrium, and he shook his head sadly. "We are entitled to some prejudice, I suppose." Van Helsing returned to the corpse and bent over it once more with his surgical implements. "Is this truly necessary?" demanded the priest, peering over his shoulder with distaste as the Dutchman severed the head from the body. "To ensure that the body is never reanimated by the undead, the head must be severed," nodded Van Helsing dispassionately. "Then the flowers of wild garlic which I have brought must be placed into its mouth. But no word of this must ever be revealed outside this crypt." He took some wild garlic flowers from his bag.
"Not from my mouth, doctor," agreed Father McCarthy. "Oh, but I wish that you had arrived sooner and prevented this tragedy."
"Let us now be honest with each other," Van Helsing said, as he motioned Father McCarthy to help him lift the coffin lid back into place. "Did you know that Pierce had fallen prey to the undead?" The priest shrugged. "How is one to know such things? I knew only what I told you earlier of my friend's fears. I knew the curse of the Mont Carberries, that some evil had gripped this house. That is all I knew." Van Helsing finished screwing back the coffin lid. "There, now, he is true dead of Christ," he breathed. "Standing back, perhaps you will say a prayer?" The priest hesitated. "I do not think that it is proper." Van Helsing frowned, puzzled. "Not proper? When we have released his soul into merciful rest?"
"How can you be so sure?"
"Believe me, Father, I'm sure, and have no regrets for my work this night. The only thing I do regret is that you dispatched his soul before even could identify the great undead who attempted this evil." He broke off abruptly as his ears caught a faint sound in the night air. There was a flapping sound, a soft noise, like the gentle beat of wings, slowly and rhythmically, pulsating against the air. Van Helsing felt a momentary chill. He turned slowly towards the door of the crypt. A figure was forming as if from a mist. A tall figure. A tall man with a large brown beard. The eyes glowed malignant and red in the darkness.
"Dragan," breathed Van Helsing.
The man stood still, arms folded across his broad chest. His expression was filled with hatred. "You have destroyed him. For that, I will take my revenge. You think you can destroy us? We are legion, and the earth is ours to inherit." The great vampire leapt towards Van Helsing, who stumbled back and fell, the crucifix flying from his hand, even as he attempted to raise it in an effort to protect himself and ward off the attack. It vanished into the dim recess behind one of the coffins. Van Helsing lay stunned a moment, unable to move, as the undead thing towered over him with a sneer of triumph.
"Stop!"
Van Helsing was aware of Father McCarthy almost screaming the word. "In the name of Christ, I command you!" The priest had pushed his way past Van Helsing and placed himself before the man. He barred Dragan's path, holding up his hand. The massive form did not halt. One giant hand came up and seized the priest by the throat, in spite of McCarthy's youth and strength, and held him at arm's length, a good foot above the ground. The priest struggled, desperate for air. Then the vampire threw him across the crypt, as if he had been no more than a rag doll. There was a sickening impact of flesh against stone as the priest hit the wall and slithered down to the floor like a broken toy. With his mouth working, the specks of blood flying from his lips, which were drawn back over the yellowing teeth, the vampire turned towards Van Helsing. The professor had scrambled to his knees, realizing that he had stumbled backwards over a discarded spade left by some lazy workman. For want of any other weapon, he seized it and swung it with all his might as Dragan came at him. The edge of the spade caught against the neck of the creature, and to his amazement, the pure iron of the working edge sliced into the creature's neck. With a scream of agony, Dragan's charge was halted, and he stumbled back. Van Helsing seized the spade with both hands and clambered to his feet, advancing on the creature and swinging again with all his might. Iron was pure. He dimly recalled that fact. Evil could not stand against purity. He felt the blade cut into Dragan. The creature went down before him, and standing over the writhing form of the undead, Van Helsing brought the spade down with all the force that he could muster directly into the heart of the thing. One long, agonized cry assailed his ears, and then the body started to waxen in death. Van Helsing stared at it in surprise. He had expected the flesh to fall away, the bones begin to crumble until nothing but dust lay on the floor of the crypt. But Dragan's corpse remained. With growing horror, Van Helsing realized that Dragan could only recently have been seduced to the ranks of the undead. He was not the source, not the great undead that he thought. If he had been, then the body would have withered. Then who? Van Helsing stared down, shivering a little. A groan caused him to raise his head. Van Helsing limped to the side of the body of Father McCarthy. There was nothing he could do, and yet the priest was still alive. He coughed blood and tried to speak. Van Helsing bent forward, trying to catch the words that strangled in the man's throat. "Miss Sarah, danger. You must go to her. Save her. Pierce feared the curse.
the curse of the undead. Miss Sarah, too, is of the seventh generation. Befin's curse is on her now. But if Dragan is not the undead, frowned Van Helsing, who then? The creature who haunted the family. The creature who cursed the family. The creature was Befin. Befin who cursed the seed of a Walter Fitzwilliam. Van Helsing was agitated. What are you saying? Another form of rendering Befin? Bebin. Go, save Miss Sarah from Bebin. Father McCarthy fell back, the last strength of his body being expended in his effort. Van Helsing started up, a coldness within him as he rose to his feet. Mrs. Bebin. Befin was Mrs. Bebin, a great undead, who fed off her own children every seventh generation since. If the priest was right, then Miss Sarah was in terrible danger, as her brother had been. She was alone at Castle Carberry with his fiend. He had not a moment to lose. Van Helsing found his horse standing patiently where he had tethered it. He mounted, and crouching low along its neck, dug his heels firmly into its rib, riding as he had never ridden in his life. It was more due to the horse's good sense than Van Helsing's uninspired horsemanship that the beast sped straight along the tortuous trackway through the moonlit woods towards Castle Carberry. The Georgian mansion stood in darkness as he approached the front of the building. Reining in a flurry of flying gravel, Van Helsing almost fell from the beast and stumbled to the door. To his surprise, he found it open and burst into the house. It seemed deserted, although a single lamp burnt in the hallway. God, if he were too late. If the fiend Bebin had reached young Sarah already. He grabbed the lamp and sped up the stairs two at a time. A shadow stirred on the landing. A shriek of rage rang out as the figure of the transformed housekeeper came rushing towards him. Blood was flecking at her mouth where her teeth gnashed against her lips. Van Helsing drew out his crucifix while feeling in his pocket for the feel of holy water he carried. Back, I order, in the name of the living God, he thundered. The malevolent creature came to a halt, hands before her eyes, as the light reflected on the silver of the cross. Van Helsing moved resolutely forward onto the main landing. Miss Sarah, where are you? He called. It is I, Van Helsing. The door of one of the rooms opened a fraction. He saw the pale, slight form of the girl framed in the doorway. Professor, thank goodness. Are you all right? Asked Van Helsing, not taking his eyes from the creature Bebin, but backed into a darkened corner of the landing. Yes, yes, what is happening? What is the matter with Mrs. Bebin? Van Helsing moved swiftly across to the girl. Stay by me for safety's sake. This Bebin is a creature of death. It was the priest who made me realize it. In his dying breath, he... Father McCarthy is dead? She interrupted in a shocked and horrified voice. Yes, I'm afraid so. Nodded Van Helsing, his eyes, not leaving the angry but baffled figure of the housekeeper, who now and then attempted to move in half-hearted, threatening fashion towards them. Van Helsing took out the feel of holy water and told Sarah to move back in her room. Then he bent down and allowed the water to spill along the threshold of the bedroom door, knowing that the undead creature would not be able to pass over it. He pushed Sarah back inside the bedchamber and followed her beyond the protection of the door. Bebin's scream of baffled rage followed them. "What do you intend to do?" demanded the girl. "Do? About that creature?" Van Helsing jerked his head towards the door. "We'll wait until dawn, and then I will track her to a resting place and destroy her." He suddenly frowned as a thought struck him. Yet if Bebin was undead, and Dragan as well, how did they function in this house as servants when they had to rest from sunrise to sunset? How? He heard Sarah's sharp intake of breath behind him. He was about to turn when he felt something hard knock into him. The crucifix went flying out of his hand through the doorway into the hall beyond, sliding out of reach. Van Helsing stumbled, and when he regained his balance, he turned with a growing feeling of apprehension. Sarah Mount Carberry stood transformed. Her eyes were twin pools of malignant fire, red and flickering. The teeth had grown longer, great yellowing fangs from which the lips were pulled back to show the white, decaying gums. "Puny, foolish man," the voice was venomous. "You thought to outwit me as you outwitted my lover? You never had a chance." Van Helsing blinked. His mind worked desperately, trying to adjust to events that moved too fast for him to understand.
Your lover?
His voice strangled in his dry throat. The creature which the girl had become gave a sneering laugh.
Had you pursued your inquiries a little more vigorously, you would have known that 2 years ago I left for a tour of the East, traveling to Turkey, my way through the beautiful Carpathians. There I met him. He taught me, nurtured me, and then bade me return here while he prepared to follow. I was to join him at Carfax. Then I heard how you and your friends thwarted and destroyed him. Van Helsing swallowed hard.
Carfax. Then you speak of Count Dracula. When he died, I was reborn. I became complete, as he had been, just as he had intended. By coincidence, I learnt from my brother that you had been his teacher once. How prosaic. It was I who proselytized Dragan and Bebin to my cause, and my puny brother. We were going to wreak such vengeance on those who destroyed my Dracula. But I still shall. The plan to send for you was easy to make. You swallowed the bait. You came to rescue my brother, and you have had some luck. That is now ended. There is no one to rescue you from my revenge. Van Helsing felt utterly helpless as this beautiful creature of the night threw back her slender white throat and gave vent to the most hideous laughter that he had ever heard. With anguish, he realized that Father McCarthy had been wrong about the ancient curse of the Mount Carberries. It had been no more than a legend. This was the new reality. His mind thought frantically for a way out, for some means of protection. He saw Bebin beyond the door, her fangs bared in something meant as a smile of triumph. His path to his crucifix was obstructed. He glanced desperately around. He was aware of her voice whispering his name gently, sighing his name as if it were the sound of a faint breeze, his name upon the wind. He felt a bitter irony, a mocking resignation. He had been confounded by the slip of a girl. Abraham Van Helsing, even though he was now in his early 60s, had never ceased to have an eye for a pretty girl. Perhaps that was why he had never been satisfied with a single relationship. Women found his only dependable quality was a constant adoration of feminine beauty. Many of his fellow academics at Amsterdam's old university found that both surprising and sometimes embarrassing. One of them once sagely remarked that women would eventually be the death of old Bram Van Helsing.